Hey guys, welcome to the Brock Cannon Podcast. This is episode number 39. When I first started going back and forth with Jeremy Jackson, I really didn't know too much about his life. He commented on a video that I had on my Woke Men Men's Group Instagram page and ended up sharing it. And I thought that was cool. What a nice guy. And then started diving a little deeper into his life and realized that this was the guy that was like a childhood movie star. He starred on the hit TV show Baywatch. Yep, the original Baywatch back in the day with David Hasselhoff, and played the role of Hobie, David Hasselhoff's son. He ended up doing 10 or maybe even 11 seasons on Baywatch and went into doing a whole bunch of other movies, but ultimately ended up on tour as a musician, going around the world, rocking stages, and just basically having quote-unquote everything. We get into a very conscious conversation in this episode about what it means to have everything, talking about the trap of external validation, the trap of getting caught up in the trophies. And Jeremy has a really fascinating journey with, you know, going into drugs and alcohol and recovery, and then ultimately finding that the greatest treasure was right within himself. He found breath work, he started developing a spiritual practice, and now is on a mission to help others reach their internal bliss as well. So I think you guys are going to absolutely love this conversation. I got so much out of it. Jeremy's an amazing individual, and without further ado, Jeremy Jackson. All right, everyone. Hey, welcome back to the Brock Cannon Podcast. So stoked today to be with Jeremy Jackson here on this episode. Jeremy and I, like many people do these days, just connected recently through social media, through my Woke Men's Instagram page, and started just going back and forth and like had some synergy and realized we were on a similar path of alignment in many ways, breath work and consciousness and just healing. And thought we'd jump on today and talk about masculinity and breath work and recovery and just life in general. And God knows where else the conversation will lead us. So Jeremy, without further ado, man, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Brock, so much. Pleasure to be on the show. Thanks so much for having me. Thank you so much for the message, you know what I mean? And being the change and, you know, showing your light, man, so other guys can heal. Really appreciate that.
Yeah, it's so good to have you, man. And for those that are not familiar with your whole backstory and biography, which I'll have, you know, more on the introduction here, but give us just a snapshot of, you know, a little bit of your life story and background here.
Right on, no problem. You know, it's I never lead with it. I usually try to avoid it and try to intervene with as much current, you know, things going on in my life that I actually believe are way more rock star status than, you know, my fame through childhood and stuff. But it seems to be a nice little wedge into the door to perk people's ears or open their eyes a little bit. Like, you know, fame is something that a lot of people aspire to have or think they want, you know, and I would tell all those people just be ready to pay a price. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's not all it's cracked up to be. So I grew up on television. You know, I started acting at the age of 6, and I did over 60 commercials. I did a bunch of movies. And by the time I was 6 years old, I landed the role of David Hasselhoff's son, Hobie Buchanan, on a little TV show back then called Baywatch. You know, I grew up at the beach. I had a single parent already. And, you know, I lived in Orange County. So driving all the way up to LA with all these little actor kids with their stage moms and their perfect hair and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I was like sandy and like sunburned, and I had just come from the pool swimming with friends, and it was just like a fit. So boom, I was already surfing and boogie boarding and all that stuff. And so I got the role. I was on Baywatch for 11 years, played David Hasselhoff's son until I was 21 years old, man. And, you know, Baywatch to this day is the number one most watched television show in the history of the world. It's in the Guinness Book of World Records. You know, it was kind of just like something that nobody ever would have guessed would have gone so big. And because of Baywatch and because of being so close with David Hasselhoff, I ended up recording and distributing two albums that I got like a few top 10 hits. So I traveled all over Europe performing in front of concerts, 15,000 people doing all this crazy stuff, performance. And you know, showmanship was always just kind of in my genes from a little kid. It's something that I pictured in my head growing up. I saw myself rocking stages. You know, I saw myself signing autographs at the age of like 3 years old. I idolized these celebrities who seemed to wield this power over people to make them fall to their knees and like pass out. Like, I love you. I was like, oh my gosh, I want people to love me that much. What do I got to do? And I didn't really know it was a career or you could make money at it. I just thought, wow, that looks neat. And I'm pretty sure I manifested it, man, because I worked on it. I spent hours and hours and hours in my room, locked in my room, practicing for, you know, what I didn't even understand because I was so little, but doing dance routines and recording my voice on a tape recorder and interviewing myself as somebody else and dressing up in costumes. Like, this was a craft that I, you know, toiled over morning and night working on it, accents and all that stuff. Nobody was paying me to do it. I didn't know it could be a career and that I would really ever get famous, but I just had a passion for it. And luckily I did that because I ended up really needing those skills. So, you know.
Well, that's an amazing way to grow up, man. I have a couple friends as well that grew up doing TV as kids, and it's an interesting life, you know, different than most. And, you know, you kind of mentioned fame sometimes may not be all it's cracked up to be. So what was maybe some of the dark side of that? And, you know, maybe some of the things that, I guess, changed you and your path from that.
Yeah. Well, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, and, you know, obviously we can't change anything in the past, but, you know, it could, you know, it just can really warp you. I mean, you know, you get used to making money so easily, you know, being, let's put it this way, you know, being 16 with, you know, making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, being kind of the man of your household, being the breadwinner, being the shot caller. People need you. You got agents, managers. Is about the exterior too. Gosh, man, that was ingrained in me. I still have to battle that. You know, it's all about getting ready for something huge. I mean, there's pluses and minuses, you know, always having to, you know, look right, hair perfect, eyebrows waxed, perfect tan, bronzer if you're not tan enough to be the beach boy, perfect cherry beach boy all the time for this role or that role or this audition, you know, what people expect, you know, how they expect you're going to be or assume you're going to be. I mean, the weirdest part was social life. I mean, you can't even be quiet. You can't be quiet and sit somewhere by yourself because everybody just assumes you're a, you know, flailing a-hole, you know, or if you, you know, if you try to jump in and join the conversation, people are like, oh, he acts that way because he thinks he's better than us, or he thinks he's got, you know, we should all pay attention to him because he's famous, or I don't know whether to believe this story you're telling me or not, because you're an actor and you could be lying to me. I don't know. Right. Maybe just wow. You know, there's no limit to how twisted that can get you if you allow it to. So I believe it actually kind of really created more of the man I am today, because like I said, when I was young, all I really wanted to do was interact, was connect. You know, I wanted that deep connection of wow, you know, of applause and approval, a job well done, that performance mentality. The harder I try, the more I work at this, then people will love me, you know. So as a teenager, I started really having to, you know, steer around the fame thing and focus on other things, you know. You know, prove myself in other ways that would maybe lead to a laundry list of achievements and or, you know, similarities with other people that then maybe when they found out or figured out that I grew up on TV, which creates this strange paradigm, that they might at least be able to counterweigh it against, well, actually, he was pretty cool, you know, and it took a long time. He seems nice. Maybe he's not a jerk or whatever.
Yeah, I think we've got a lot of similarities, man. In some ways, I never grew up in fame by any means, but the part I really resonate with you talking about is just this need for external validation. And I think as men, we deal with that. It's like the chase is always there, whether that's subconsciously we're trying to impress our parents or, you know, teachers or people that like ingrained in us at a very young age, hey, if you do X, Y, and Z, you're successful. I was a professional mountain bike racer for a lot of years. And so, I mean, I remember I was so unhealthy in terms of like putting my entire happiness based on a training day. And if I didn't nail it, I'd get depressed. And I'm like,
worthless.
Shit, I didn't finish what my coach wanted me to do, or I didn't get this result at this race. And, you know, it's a dangerous road. So what would you just like, if you were talking to a bunch of guys in a circle, you know, like, what would you tell them about this need to seek external validation?
Oh man, listen, I have literally achieved, completed, owned, perfected every single exterior facet of life that people kind of tend to gravitate towards or lean towards. Maybe if you had this, maybe if I had this. I was on the cover of fitness magazines. I yoked, diesel, shredded, driving Lamborghinis, supermodel girlfriends, penthouses, you know, I mean, all that stuff that you think, riding a beach cruiser with $5 in your pocket, no house, you know, nothing else. That's like as happy as anybody can ever be. Like, that's everything right there. Like, next to nothing is happier than anything else on top, because none of that stuff fixed me. It was, none of that stuff was good enough. And that mentality that it's progressive and, it doesn't end with anything, you know, it doesn't, it's never finished and it's never going to be finished. And it's always about daily, just for today, a little bit of progress, you know, spiritual progress, physical progress, mental, emotional progress. It's just about chipping away, man. And those little chips are as good as it's going to get. Like, today has to be as good as it's ever going to be, you know? And that's the truth, because like I said, I had managers, I had agents, I had publicists, I had stylists, I had, you know, money flowing in. I had the chicks, everybody wanted me, everybody loved me. And what else, what's like the dream that people, if everybody just loved me, you know, seas of people chanting my name, still not good enough. You know, maybe, you know, it was cool in the moment. I had, my heart was rushing and I was like, but then what next, you know, then after that. So just dropping any and all of that stuff is going to catapult you into like the moment. And that's the raddest place to be.
So what was kind of the catalyst for your, I guess, inner healing and journey, where you did you have one wake up moment where you were kind of like, wow, I put so much emphasis in this external shit and now I really need to go inward? Did you have a mentor? Did you have an experience? What kind of led you back inside of yourself to realize that this is peace?
Yeah, so many mentors along the way, so many amazing people that have been put into my life, and you know, so many aha moments, you know, so many bottoms, spiritual bottoms, emotional bottoms, you know, life just happening like, holy crap, you know, destruction of finances or destruction of, you know, physical health or whatever, it's all happened good and bad. But those aha moments and those wake up calls, you know, and those like, everything's going to be different now, or, now I see, or it all makes sense. None of them matter unless followed by practical application, you know, these ways of processing life, whether it's good, bad, and the acceptance that comes along just with every moment of every day, is like how I try to live today. You know, because I can have these moments, aha moments, and then 6 months later, like nothing changed, or I have another horrible thing that leads to an aha moment. I'm like, what happened the last 6 months? You know, this panic attack or what have you. Oh, I haven't like been applying, whether it's the spiritual principle, the practices, or, you know, the commitments that I've made to myself for eating or training, or the commitments that I've made to myself to connect more with family, or, you know, commitments to help somebody every day, or, you know, whatever those things are, they have to be put into practice. And it is, like I said before, that small bit of progress every day that creates a feeling of abundance, you know?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, man. Putting it into application 100%. You know, I read an article just yesterday that said, it was talking about meditation. It was like, everybody touts how cool meditation is now. And like, you know, but how many are actually doing it? Like, how many are actually sitting down? And I'm not judging, like, we all do our different forms of meditation. Some people it's 5 minutes while listening to a song they like. Some people are like 20 minutes twice a day, you know, like clockwork. So, but it was just like talking about, are we practicing it?
Yeah.
And I couldn't agree more, man. It's in the doing that.
Yeah. Otherwise it's just homework. You know, it's just like checking a box, like you read self-help books or what have you. But, you know, that's like, it's like dutiful living versus like purpose driven living. You know, when you start applying those things and really seeking and wanting to go deeper, but it takes what it takes, right? Like, I feel like all of us have to be miserable enough to finally do it first. It has to hurt bad enough, you know? And I, you know, and also a lot of ownership, you know, a lot of ownership and accountability for our part in life and our part in situations and things, and how the situations arise that end up leaving us in a place to feel hurt, betrayed, you know, down on ourselves, not loving ourselves, abusing ourselves through whatever, food, alcohol, women, you know, why is that cycle happening? And once we take the ownership for that stuff, then we can apply certain practices like we talked about to stay out of that loop.
Yeah, 100%. There's so much I want to ask you about before we kind of get into like the present day and everything that's happening for you and the man you're embodying now with yourself. Tell us just a little more, because I know you're big in the recovery movement and you're impacting a lot of people in that way. I really believe that in some way, shape or form, we're all in recovery, whether you have a history with drugs or alcohol or not. We all have our numbing devices, and especially men, like we're all numbing with something. And it's like recognizing that's this huge wake up call. So whether people that are listening are in the recovery movement or not, I thought it'd be really cool just to hear kind of your journey with recovery and, you know, where it started and where you are today.
Yeah. Fantastic, man. You know, being a drug addict, alcoholic, recovering drug addict, alcoholic, it's a blessing and a curse, you know, because like we talked about, everybody has something, right? Everybody's got a story. Everybody's got hurts and wounds that need to heal, or, you know, weaknesses and crutches, so to speak, I guess, you know, behavior that they fall back on, default behavior that's not, you know, their authentic, true, raw, vulnerable self, you know? And I say it's a blessing and a curse because for me, specifically through trial and error, self-experimentation and experience, I know that lack of and or falling back on these types of practices, this type of connection, you know, honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, self-examination, you know, pulling those splinters out of my spirit so that I can live happy, joyous, and free. You know, that's all amazing, cool people stuff to do. But for me, it's life or death. Because if I allow anger, resentment, lack of acceptance, if I start playing God and thinking that I know better than anybody else, then somehow, some way, by what we call in the recovery community a peculiar mental twist, I end up on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
As like, holy crap, you know, desolate, desperate, hopeless, disgusting, feeling like a true creature. I mean, yes, we all have days where you feel cut off from society, like maybe nobody else has it as bad as you, or you're not, I'm not going to make it, or what am I thinking? You know, we all have that, those insecurities, and we all have those off days. But, you know, living in that day in, day out type of headspace, that reptilian brain that only knows how to survive and has no connection. And it's a terrible place to be. So that's why it's a blessing in disguise, because, you know, I have to pick up on a program of rigorous action and honesty and connection with other men that are possibly hopeless or are stuck in that state. You know, if I can't, you know, if I can't, commune with them and sync heartbeats and sync pupils, then I get into that crazy brain that wants me dead, you know? Mm-hmm. So it keeps me having to do this stuff. Some people like to do it. Some people want to do it. Some people have to do it, you know?
Yeah, that's 100% true, man. And something you just said really hit me, because I was literally pondering this point this morning. It's like, one of my mentors told me, he's like, the ego wants you dead.
Uh-huh.
Really does. Like, doesn't give a shit about you. It really just wants you dead. And that's why, you know, men kind of coming into heart-centered living, I think, is so huge. So for you, you know, like with your recovery journey, obviously that world, you know, a lot of drugs, a lot of alcohol, you want to stay up all the time, all this, like, was it a gradual thing? Did you have one just rock bottom moment where it all crashed? What was that like for you?
No, you know, I believe that the science calls it the warrior gene, right? There's this hitch in the get along of the amygdala. And in 10% of the world's population, there exists this gene that's really a protective procreation mechanism so that no civilization goes extinct. They're like the Irish and the Native Americans, you hear like, oh gosh, he's Irish, he can't hold his liquor. You know, Native Americans, they're crazy, you know, give them a little whiskey, they're you know, savages, you know. And that's because, based on this scientific research, this warrior gene, because during the genocides, more people with the gene were likely to survive and then eventually procreate. So they passed on this genetic predisposition to this loop in the addict brain that once you take a drink or take a drug, it causes a cascade of dopamine in the amygdala that normally shuts off. Mm-hmm. It normally peters out in the other 90% of the world's population. But for a true addict, it can't shut off. It says, do that again or you're going to die. And that's why we talked about that reptilian brain. It just forces you out of your free thinking, forces you out of connection, forces you out of the big picture, and just wants you to do anything and everything right then and there to stay alive. And it's also a blessing and a curse, you know, because people with this gene can really connect to other people with this gene. Like, we've really felt the same. We've really experienced the same. I want to stop and can't. Why can't I stop? You know, my daughter's being born in the hospital right now. I don't have a daughter, but just, you know, my wife's in the hospital, but I'm shit drunk and I'm thinking one more line of cocaine, and I missed my daughter's birth. Like, big events like this happening in people's lives, car crashes where you hurt somebody, kill somebody. What is wrong with me that I would do that? I know it's wrong, but I did it anyway. So it's a pretty scary thing for people. And a lot of times they think it's, you know, it's me. I'm a bad person. I'm careless. I'm, you know, inconsiderate. But no, you can't argue with biology. You can't force yourself to not, you know, get tan. It's like, okay, this release of melanin happened from the sun hitting your skin and boom, now you're tan. You couldn't will it, you know, to not happen. You can't will that gene to shut down. And the serotonin created by two people talking to one another who trust, believe in likeness, you know, then that gene's quieted down. And all of a sudden the urge, the imperious urge to have to do something is quelled. And that's how we, you know, connect and don't have to do it. So, you know, I believe I was born with that. I believe I was born with that because at a very early age, I grew up with without a dad. This seems to be a common theme in a lot of really hurt men, you know, and the need for approval, performance, and accolades to be accepted through a job well done was really my first drug, you know, and right. I got a high off that, you know,
right.
And I was always looking outside myself to cure an interior pain, an interior problem. Life didn't seem to make sense to me. And I thought that from a very, very early age, before I even knew what drugs and alcohol were, my little brain was like, there's got to be some potion. It's a potion. There's some kind of magical tonic I can drink that will like, and then suddenly I'll get it. People around me seem to get it. I don't know what it is, but I don't feel like I get it, fit in, am a part of, belong here. I don't feel like I belong here. This doesn't make sense to me. And I remember a lot of pain. So, you know, whether it was like smoking cigarettes or smoking weed as a kid, just searching to feel like I got it. You know, and you temporarily do find that in drugs and alcohol. You temporarily do find community and acceptance, you know, but the people that accept you are worse off than you. And right. then you end up worse off. And then you have to find people even worse off to accept you. And before you know it, you're just like homeless and like, all right, I get, you know, at least I'm accepted.
Right.
It's pretty right. gnarly. So I've run through the gamut with drugs and alcohol. Yeah, I've been at the top, I've been at the bottom. And, about 6 years ago now, I became a drug and alcohol counselor. And that's really when I discovered breath work, you know. So I spent some years doing, breath work healing in rehabs and in detoxes. And, you know, we did some bereavement groups and I worked with a lot of people one-on-one and man, transformative to the max, bro. I mean, that's, you asked me earlier if there was a big moment in, you know, there's, like I said, there's many, but the first time I ever did breath work and knowing like, whoa, like that's the closest to God I've ever been and might ever be. And I want to do this. There's no doubt that this is real, really, really real. You know, the most yeah. real, honest, understood. Oh gosh, we all just want to be understood. No one's ever going to fully understand us in this life, right? We don't even yeah. understand ourselves. But yeah. for a brief moment to feel completely understood is magic.
Oh, dude, I got chills as you talked about that. Cause like I resonate with that, man. Like it's, and you've been practicing breathwork longer than me. I only found it about a year ago. And like that same feeling, it's like all this stuff I've been looking for on the outside, like it just brings it in here. And I think that's why it resonates so much in the recovery movement is because yeah. anyone that has addictive qualities is like, we're always looking outside our body yeah. and then it brings you back in your body. So
yeah.
for somebody that like, how would you describe what breath work does to somebody that's never done it? Like, how would you describe that?
Well, you know, when
and obviously there's different types this a lot. And stuff like that.
Yeah. You know? I yeah. did this a lot. And, you know, because I worked in rehabs with people pretty down and out, man, pretty beat up. I would always just lead with the DMT, you know, yeah. Have you guys ever smoked a DMT? Most of them hadn't, but they all wanted to, you know, do yeah. you enjoy psychedelics? What if I told you, you could get completely high on the spirit molecule, see stuff, feel stuff, go somewhere else. And it would have no negative effect on you, you know? And, you know, it's funny because, you know, if I pulled out a sack of drugs, they wouldn't even question it. They'd snort it. They'd pop it, whatever. But when I start to talk about breath work, they're like, okay, well, how long do I have to breathe for? And, you know, what am I going to feel? Or they'd be starting to get the high and they're like, stop. Wait, I feel my hands are, I'm like, I know it's part of the process, you know, just like, just stay in it, man. The breath will do all the work for you. Just breathe. So it's funny, the resistance you meet with real transformation as opposed to artificial superficial, temporary relief with a drug or alcohol. But I usually go with the scientific terminology, man, that this endogenous DMT exists in us, and that through hyperoxygenation of the bloodstream, you know, you can activate that hypothalamus and get that release of DMT that can do work beyond, above, and below anything you think you might want or need. You know, and I usually start people off really slow. You know, I go real slow because when I was first getting into breath work, you know, I would do it really intense, and I was taught really intense for, you know, for a good 30 minutes intense. And it was, I went through these periods of like crippling pain, like stored trauma, like, oh my God, like my spleen is going to jump out of my body, or my knee, or it would be all this, like, oh, I'd be like weeping. I'd be screaming in agonizing pain, you know, like feels like sometimes your back is broken, you know? And I remember being like really timid to do it again. Like, oh, do I really, can I even handle all that today? Am I willing to face that much? Oh, my throat would start to, you know, like a, that, like you're going to cry feeling, even when I would think about breathing. Oh, no. So there's a lot of resistance. So I start people off really, really slow, and then ramp them up to like medium, and then like get them in, because, you know, it's intense, man.
It is, man. Like, I think so much about this, because it's like, you want to just tell everyone, like, herein lies the answers to so many of your problems.
Sure.
Like herein lies the answer. But people hear breath work and they hear work. And they're like, shit, yeah, I don't want to do work. I just want to take a pill, or like, you know, like do more coffee like late in the afternoon. And then they hear, and so you say, okay, how about just breathing? But then breathing sounds too simple, because we do it every day, 25,000 times a day. So it's like, I totally get that. It's like people don't know until they experience that. So I love that you start them slow and gentle. And yeah, it can be really traumatic in the beginning if they've never done it.
Absolutely.
Like releasing.
Yeah, but yeah, I also always say you gotta feel it to heal it, you know? You gotta feel it to heal it, man. You gotta go through it. That you can tell a lot about people, man. When you got a room of 20 people breathing or what have you, and you're looking around the room, and like you could just see who's resistant, who's willing, who's overconfident. Like you can't keep any secrets during breath work. You know, you shine. All your issues are pretty glaring when you're there. You know, are you the type of person who wants to give up when it gets a little uncomfortable? You know, are you the kind of person who is gonna, you know, just go halfway? You know, are you willing to settle for less? Like, there's just so much you can tell about yourself and about other people.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Talk to us a little bit about your breathwork practice today. Like, do you practice every day? Do you do it in the morning? Do you do it at night? Do you do it as on demand?
You know, gosh, I used to add it to everything, man. Like did it before all my Brazilian jiu-jitsu tournaments. You know, that was huge. So I've been competing in jiu-jitsu for a few years. And, you know, when I was younger, white belt, blue belt, you know, I'd get really amped up, you know, I'd get my stretching in or whatever. And I'd do like a bunch of jumps and like, like gorilla chest bangs and, you know, and I can remember going into the tournament. I really couldn't feel my body from the waist down. You know, I couldn't feel my feet on the mat. You know, my feet felt kind of cold and unconnected. And, you know, once the fight started, everything changed. But once I got a little older, purple belt and stuff, and started competing, and I started implementing breath work. And I mean, then you walk on the mat and you're just like, I'm so here right now. Holy crap. I could feel the mat. My whole body was there. And it changed my game completely. As a matter of fact, I stopped wanting to even compete anymore. I realized through breath work and competing that I no longer had the need to prove anything in my jiu-jitsu practice. And I lost that, or surrendered that need to be the champ. You know, it was really cool. So it's transitioned a lot of my life. I've been doing a lot of frequency kind of healing, audio meditations and certain hurts and all that kind of stuff. And doing some breathing with that. I've been teaching a little bit, but I'll do breath work maybe once a week now. Mm-hmm. You know, once a week is probably about what I'll do these days. And I've been skipping a little bit, you know, when one thing picks up, another starts to dwindle, you know what I mean? So maybe this conversation is meant to get me back in my practice more often.
Yeah. Right on, man. What other practices are really grounding for you? You mentioned, you know, meditation. I do the same thing, you know, getting the binaural beats and, you know, really tuning to that frequency. That's a beautiful thing. What other practices have really been pivotal in your healing?
Jiu-jitsu for sure. You know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu for sure. You know, it's all about the path of least resistance. It's very cerebral. And, you know, if something's not working, you know, don't try harder, you know, try another way, try a different way, you know, and, you know, how many ways can you try before you give up and decide to have ego or quit, you know, or do what's safe. You know? So it's every little jiu-jitsu role is a microcosm for life, you know, and just enjoying the process and figuring out your mistakes. And, you know, it's really incredible when you're mindful jiu-jitsu practice. And also just the act of getting up at 5 a.m. and showing up at 6, you know, even when you feel like crap, that's big for, you know, mental toughness and creating consistency in your routine. I always feel like a champion when I don't want to go and I go anyway. And it's like, I forget until it's done. I can't recall the triumphant feeling of facing all of my stuff yesterday, even though it felt amazing. Today somehow feels like a different day that won't yield the same rewards, right? Because we're battling a lot up there.
Right.
So those are little wins every day. I attend regular mentorship group meetings, you know. I have a spiritual advisor and I'm going through this pretty awesome awakening process through these steps and practices of really just freedom and ownership, you know. And I'll share a little piece with you that's been so enlightening, man, that anyone can apply to a problem in their life, a person, a problem, or, you know, a situation from their past or, you know, could have been yesterday, but where, you know, you take this person, this place, or this thing that, you know, you still have feelings over, you know, regret, remorse, shame, and anger, you know, fear, whatever that feeling that, you know, some stuff happens, it's gone, it's over, you know, that was no big deal, you know, but some stuff sticks to you, you know what I mean? And those sticky things seem to, you know, create repeating those types of situations with other people or with career, you know, decision making or lifestyle choices. They seem to just reappear their ugly heads and you know, manifest in different ways where we can't even see it. We can no longer see that it's from that other one, you know, that other trauma that happened. So, you know, take this person, we'll just make one up, you know, this ex-girlfriend, and, you know, what did she do? So you take this ex-girlfriend, you put her down on paper, you know, what did she do? She lied to me. She cheated on me, or she, never listened to me and da 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 da, whatever, all the things she did, it did, they did, what have you, you know. And then you make this list of of things that it affected. You know, it affected your pride, your ego, your ambition, your pocketbook, you know, your sexual relations, your relations with other people. You know, you make this list of what it affected. And then you look at these roles that you've assigned yourself in life, you know, based on this pride and this ego and this fight, you know, like, you know, pride is how you expect people to see you, you know, the character that you've assigned yourself in this relationship or in this life. Like, well, I was good to her and I bought her and I did this and blah, blah, blah. You know, I didn't deserve that because I've assigned myself the role of Mr. Perfect or what have you. Right. You know, it's self-esteem, you know, how you expect all these expectations, you know, these ambitions, what I wanted out of, I wanted this out of that. I wanted them to treat me like this and I wanted it to go like this. These expectations and these parameters that you've put on, you know, whatever, she cheated on you. That's like a sex relation. Like my deep-seated idea of what a relationship like this should look like, you know, or what a real man would have done in this situation. So there's all these areas of self, six areas of self actually. And then you start to get into, all right, there it was, here's what I expected. She did that. It was far from what I expected and then caused me to feel this way. And I'm harmed, blah, 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 blah. So then you take a look at, in this next column, you take a look at the action that you took. What was the action that I took? Well, you know, everybody kind of knew she was a bitch, but none of my friends liked her. My mom told me not to. You know, there's all these, like, there was a lot of signs. There usually always is, right? It's like very rarely do we get blindsided or, you know, you know, I took this action. I kind of, well, yeah. You know, okay, so I got into a relationship with this lady who, you know, I kind of probably did have some warnings, you know, signs that I could have paid attention to and didn't. And then what was the thought? What was the thought you had that allowed you to take that action? Well, the thought was, maybe this time it'll be different, or I'll be the change, you know, I'll be strong enough in this relationship to make what is, a codependent, not codependent anymore, or what have you, or, you know, she was just super hot. You know, there's a million thoughts. Like, she's so hot, you know, or maybe this is the best chick I've ever got. I didn't want to be alone. You know, I had this thought, I don't want to be alone. And that allowed me to get into a relationship, take the action of getting a relationship with someone that there was warning signs. So what was the fear? What was the fear attached to the thought that allowed you to take the action? Well, the fear was, you know, maybe that's the I don't want to be alone one. Or the fear was, this is the best girl. She's the hottest thing I'm going to be able to get. That's all I deserve. That's all I'm good enough for. She had money and I thought we could pay the bills together. I don't know. There's always a fear that you have to find that allowed you to have a thought that allowed you to take an action. And then the last one after the fears is all of the harms, the wreckage, the people, the institutions, so on and so forth that materialized from this relationship. Oh crap. You know, that my family members, you know, we had this breakup and I was on the phone with everybody, you know, my buddies, or, you know, then I got drunk and I got a DUI because of it, you know, all the harms. And once, then you got to also, the harms are big, because then you start to realize, holy crap, these little insecure thoughts that I have, these fearful thoughts that I have that allow me to take these actions, that allow me to have these relationships with finances or people or what have you, they hurt a lot of people. It's not just me, you know, that I hurt, you know, I didn't show up to work one day because of this, and that harmed my career. Like, I'm harming, wow, these choices based on self are not just hurting me, they're hurting a lot of people. Now, obviously, finally, you kind of say a say a prayer for that person, to be protected from anger against that person, that place, or that thing, and kind of release them into the universe through some, from some, you know, some sympathy and empathy. You know, have I ever done this to somebody? Did I ever lie, cheat, or steal? Did I ever, you know, withhold information? You know, and then what they did to you becomes really not very important at all, because you could see a type of bad day, a type of harsh childhood, a type of shitty life that might allow you to do that to somebody else. And you're like, you know what? I've already done that. Or, you know what? I can kind of imagine doing. I can't imagine if I had their upbringing, if I walked them out in their shoes, maybe, I guess, you know what? They're not that bad of a person after all. And really my part in this is far more glaring. And these people that I harmed, this can't happen anymore. And that this thing that I'm doing with everything in my life and everything in my past, is creating so much freedom. It is amazing through relationships, through business relationships that I've had, you know, family life, anything that I've done successfully or lost, or it doesn't really matter. Working this process to let it go is allowing me to feel so, so, so free. And that's actually found in a 12-step program of any sort, whether it's gamblers or overeaters or alcoholics, cutters, and sex and love, all of that kind of stuff. This process of acceptance, finding your part on a deep level, and realizing how much it takes and how many others it hurts, really sets you up to not repeat those patterns anymore. I hope I explained that. It's a new process, but I hope I explained it well.
No, man, that's a beautiful process. And I can imagine incredibly freeing, and you know, something you said towards the end there of that process, like, just eyes wide open, and and being able to then approach people from the lens of empathy and compassion and be like, that makes sense now. Like, oh, she had this in her upbringing. He had this, you know, it's like, that kind of makes sense. We've all got baggage. We've all got issues. And then when you kind of see everyone walking around like, wow, there's a lot more people out here with problems than I realized. I'm not the only one.
Right. And forgiveness is really not for them. It's for us, you know?
Yeah. I'm so glad you just...
Go ahead.
I'm so glad you just mentioned that, because that was another thing I was thinking and feeling as you were saying that, is the power of forgiveness. So for people that don't forgive, like, what is that really doing to them? And then maybe just any more thoughts you'd have on forgiveness, I would love to hear.
Well, you know, I think, you know, as men, we're like riding this fine line of being emasculated and being, you know, a man, you know, the cookie cutter man, you know, and, you know, screw that person, F that person. No, I'm going to, you know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. You know, I'm just trust no one. You know, this kind of mentality,
right.
Dust yourself up, keep going. You know, it doesn't hurt unless you see the bone. that's kind of how supposedly we're supposed to be, you know, just gorillas in the sack and barracudas in business. And, you know, if someone screws you over, you know, you screw them over, you know, they cut you off, you cut them off, slam on your brakes. Oh yeah, I can do it harder than you. I'm willing to go there right now. Let's take it there. Otherwise you're like not a man. Right. So forgiveness just doesn't sound very masculine, you know?
Right.
But it's a different day and age, dude. We're not killing freaking woolly mammoths anymore. You know, we're not clubbing girls over the head and dragging them back to the cave. You know, we have to find other ways to do that. Like, don't get me wrong. No man, this is John Eldridge. I don't know if you've ever heard this, but he's freaking awesome. You know, none of us men as little kids, you know, playing Rambo, you know, G.I. Joe, cops and robbers, cowboys and Indians, you know, taking our bikes off jumps and stuff. Like, none of us were like, when I grow up, I'm going to be a nice guy. You know, we were like, I'm going to be a good man. Like, I'm going to freaking part my hair, wear a bow tie, and like walk into church and be just a good man. That's what I want to be. Nobody ever did that. And we're not created for that. We are dangerous. You know what I mean? We do need to have an edge. We are created in the image, right? Which is warring, powerful, jealous, you know, but also safety, you know, also courage and also forgiveness, right? So that's that duality, man, of being like a badass, but being super considerate and loving and kind and forgiving, but not losing your edge. And I think we sway to one side or the other because that balance is not exemplified very often. You know, I feel like you're breaking that paradigm. You're doing that. You know, we are adventurers, man. A scalpel is not safe, right? A scalpel can save a life or take a life. But in order to make the scalpel safe, you don't dull the edge. You educate the hand that it's put in, right? Mm. So that's what we're doing right here, man. That's why I need people like you in my life. And that's, you know, that's why I follow people like you. And that's why it's important to remind each other that we can still be adventurous, masculine, you know, dangerous, and loving, educated, kind, and forgiving at the same time. Man. That's the new beast mode.
So good, man. So good. So good. Yeah. So good. Last couple of questions. And one thing I've been thinking so much about is this shift in the modern masculine man to becoming more of a heart-centered man. What does it mean to you to become a heart-centered man?
Well, when I hear heart-centered man, I think of, you know, what I was taught by David Elliott, who is my breathwork teacher and kind of guru, David Elliott out of LA. He wrote the book, Reluctant Healer. If you've never checked it out, definitely check it out, man.
I'll check that out.
And I think the second book was called Healed or Healing. But, you know, do you do a two-part inhale? Do you breathe into your belly and into your chest?
Yeah, for the most part. Yes.
Cool. So like this lower energy system, like this belly is like this, is where we stuff and where we discard and hide and protect. And living from this lower energy system is kind of like a finite world, a world of limitation, a world of shame and hurt. But this upper energy system, this heart-centered system, this upper breathing, I believe is why we do that. We're shaking up both worlds. You know, mm-hmm. we're excavating and we're cracking open. And I was taught that when we live from the heart, when we give from the heart, when we exude from the heart and we receive from the heart, we're tapping into what's called the universal energy flow. And it's where our heart goes out to others. It goes right up to the heavens and comes back down. And it's a perfect system. And you don't run out of energy. You don't run out of ability. You're not in jeopardy of bad energy or juju or like getting connected and meshed into other people's worlds or hurts, you know, that's like a belly thing, you know, and some people kind of heal from that perspective. They'll really get in and feel it with you and they'll be all drained and like, oh, you know, like I love the crystals and all that stuff, but really when you're coming from the heart, man, that's all you need, right?
Yeah.
To just be the authentic self, to shine, boom, and just like, it's like, it's charging itself, man. It's coming, it's going out and coming back around. And that's how you just stay like super gangster with it, man. Like limitless.
Mm. Dude, powerful, powerful stuff, man. I love that.
Brother.
I love that. What are you most excited about right now in your life this year? What's on your radar? Talk to us about kind of your vision for this year.
You know, I'm really looking forward to hopefully getting back to work. You know, I've been doing product education and doing some employee stuff at some of our retail locations for Pachamama CBD. So I own shares in and run some lifestyle development, product education, brand ambassador stuff for Pachamama CBD. And we're in like Mother's Market. We're in getting in Whole Foods. We're in Earth Bar. We're in some really cool locations. But with COVID, man, it just really killed it, you know? Yeah. So I'm hoping to get back to work. Looking forward to that. And get back into action, meeting and greeting people, shaking hands and kissing babies, you know, sharing the Pachamama CBD love. And, you know, I'm looking forward to traveling. I'm probably going to be taking a trip to Mexico, I think, in May, if I can get it going. My passport got stolen. So I put it on my paperwork. I'd like to go to Costa Rica in the next month, depending on how everything goes. Definitely looking forward to some traveling. What else? I got a new relationship that's kind of sprouting up. So we'll see how that goes. I mean, it's good. I'm kind of in a place that, you know, everything stopped and it's coming back a little piece by piece and seeing how it reforms and reshapes.
I love it, man. Sounds like a good year. I also had my passport stolen last year in Mexico. Yeah. So that was a challenge to get back in the country.
Oh my gosh. Thank goodness you're back.
Yeah. Well, I hope you get down there, man. Have an amazing year this year and best of luck with everything you're doing. Where is the best place for people listening to reach out to you, say hello and follow your journey?
Right on, man. It's at Jeremy Jackson Fitness on Instagram. I'm pretty active on there. So, you know, if you message me or whatever, if you heard the podcast, please give a shout out. That's about it, man. I'm active on there. You can find me on anything really, Facebook or Twitter, but I'm most active on Instagram.
Awesome. Awesome, man. Well, we'll have links on all that in the show notes there. And brother, really, really genuinely enjoyed this. So we're not too far away. I hope we can get together this year and,
brother. Thank you for all you do for us guys, man. We need you.
Thank you, man. And thank you everybody for listening and love to hear your comments on the episode. We'll see you guys all next time. Peace. 's Brock here again. Before you go, I just wanted to reflect on the show. I hope you guys got as much out of that as I did. I think one of my favorite parts of the episode was when Jeremy was talking about how he, at one point, had all these external trophies, the Lamborghinis, dating supermodels, money, fame, invited to the hottest parties in Hollywood, etc. But ultimately, today, looking back, would tell you that the greatest happiness is if you only had $5 in your pocket and you could ride on the beach on your beach cruiser. Really a testament to how the simple things really are where it's at. So I hope everyone can reflect on the simple things that they already have possession of, the things that are nearest and dearest to their heart today. Take that as a lesson. And I hope you guys will reach out to Jeremy as well. He's always got some really cool videos, a lot of fitness stuff, and just good personal development content. So I'll have links in the show notes to all of his social channels, etc. Thank you guys for watching. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please feel free to share it and keep on keeping on. We'll see you on the next episode.